two siblings looking up at her from Count Olaf's backyard. But Violet had built a grappling hook to rescue her, and Klaus had done some important legal research to defeat Olaf's scheme. As the car took Sunny farther and farther away from her siblings, and she stared out at the lonesome terrain, she knew that they could save her again.
"How long will we stay on Mount Fraught?"
Hugo asked.
"Until I say so, of course,"
Count Olaf replied.
"You'll soon find out that much of this job involves a lot of waiting around,"
the hook-handed man said.
"I usually keep something around to help pass the time, like a deck of cards or a large rock."
"It can be dull," admitted one of the white-faced women, "and it can be dangerous. Several of our comrades have recently suffered terrible fates."
"It was worth it,"
Count Olaf said nonchalantly, a word which here means, in a tone of voice that indicated he didn't care one bit about his deceased employees.
"Sometimes a few people need to die in fires or get eaten by lions, if it's all for the greater good."
"What's the greater good?"
asked Colette.
"Money," Esme cried in greedy glee. "Money and personal satisfaction, and we're going to get both of those things out of this whimpering baby on my lap.
Once we have our hands on the Baudelaire fortune, we'll have enough money to live a life of luxury and plan several more treacherous schemes."
The entire troop cheered, and Count Olaf gave Sunny a filthy grin, but did not say anything more as the car raced up a steep, bumpy hill, and at last screeched to a halt, just as the last rays of the sun faded into the evening sky.
"We're here at last,"
Count Olaf said, and handed the car keys to Sunny.
"Get out, baby orphan. Unload everything from the trunk, and set up the tents."
"And bring us some potato chips," Esme said, "so we'll have something in to eat while we wait."
Esme opened the door of the car, placed Sunny on the frozen ground, and slammed the door shut again. Instantly, the chilly mountain air surrounded the youngest Baudelaire and made her shiver. It was so bitterly cold at the highest peak of the Mortmain Mountains that her tears froze in their tracks, forming a tiny mask of ice all over her face. Unsteadily, Sunny rose to her feet and walked to the back of the car. She was tempted to keep walking and escape from Olaf while he waited in the car with his troop, but where could she go? Sunny looked around at her surroundings and could not see a place where a baby would be safe by herself. The summit of Mount Fraught was a small, flat square, and as Sunny walked to the trunk of the car, she gazed off each edge of the square, feeling a bit dizzy from the great height. From three of the edges, she could see the square and misty peaks of some of the other mountains, most of which were covered in snow, and twisting through the peaks were the strange black waters of the stricken stream and the rocky path that the car had driven along. But from the fourth side of the square peak, Sunny saw something so strange, it took her a moment to figure out what it was. Extending from the highest peak in the Mortmain Mountains was a glittering white strip, like an enormous piece of shiny paper folded downward, or the wing of some tremendous bird. Sunny watched the very last rays of the sunset reflect off this enormous surface and slowly realized what it was, the source of the stricken stream. Like many streams, the stricken stream originated within the rocks of the mountains, and in the warmer season, Sunny could see that it cascaded down from the highest peak in an enormous waterfall. But this was not a warm time of year, and just as Sunny's tears had frozen on her face, the waterfall had frozen solid into a long, slippery slope that disappeared into the darkness below. It was such an eerie sight that it took Sunny a moment to wonder why the ice was white instead of black, like the waters of the stricken stream.
"Honk!"
A loud blast from Count Olaf's horn made Sunny remember what she was supposed to be doing, and she hurriedly opened the trunk and found a bag of potato chips, which she brought back to the car.
"That took a very long time, Orphan," said Olaf, rather than "thank you." "Now go set up the tents, one for Esme and me, and one for my troop, so we can get some sleep."
"Where is the baby guide to stay?"
asked the hook-handed man.
"I don't want her in my tent. I hear that babies can creep up and steal your breath while you're sleeping."
"Well, she's certainly not sleeping with me," Esme said. "It's not in to have a baby in your tent."
"She's not going to sleep in either tent," Olaf decided. "There's a large covered casserole dish in the trunk. She can sleep in there."
"Will she be safe in a casserole dish?" Esme said. "Remember, Olaf, honey, if she dies, then we can't get our hands on the fortune."
"There are a few holes in the top, so she can breathe," Olaf said, "and the cover will protect her from the snow gnats."
"Snow gnats?"
asked Hugo.
"Snow gnats are well-organized, ill-tempered insects," Count Olaf explained, "who live in cold mountain areas and enjoy stinging people for no reason whatsoever. I've always been fond of them."
"Nenat,"
Sunny said, which meant, "I didn't notice any such insects outside." But no one paid any attention.
"Won't she run away if no one's watching her?"
asked Kevin.
"She wouldn't dare," Count Olaf said. "And even if she tried to survive in the mountains by herself, we could see where she went. That's why we're staying here at the summit. We'll know if the brat escapes, or if anyone's coming after us, because we can see everything and everyone for miles and miles."
"Eureka,"
Sunny said, before she could stop herself. She meant something along the lines of, "I've just realized something," but she had not meant to say it out loud.
"Stop your babbling and get busy, you fanged brat,"
Esme Squalor said, and slammed the car door shut. Sunny could hear the laughing of the troop and the crunching of potato chips as she walked slowly back to the trunk to find the tents. It is often quite frustrating to arrange all of the cloth and the poles so a tent works correctly, which is why I have always preferred to stay in hotels or rented castles, which also have the added attractions of solid walls and maid service. Sunny, of course, had the extra disadvantages of trying to do it herself, in the dark, when she was still fairly new at walking and was worried about her siblings. But the youngest Baudelaire had a history of performing Herculean tasks, a phrase which here means managing to do incredibly difficult things. As I'm sure you know, if you are ever forced to do something very difficult, it often helps to think of something inspiring to keep you going. When Sunny had engaged in a sword-and-tooth fight at Lucky Smell's lumber mill, for instance, she thought of how much she cared for her siblings, and it helped her defeat the evil Dr. Orwell. When Sunny climbed up an elevator shaft at 667 Dark Avenue, she had concentrated on her friends the Quagmires and how much she wanted to rescue them, and before too long she had reached the penthouse apartment. So, as Sunny dug a hole in the frozen ground with her teeth so the tent poles would stay in place, she thought of something that inspired her. And oddly enough, it was something that Count Olaf had said about being able to see everything and everyone for miles and miles. As Sunny assembled the tents and gazed down every so often at the slippery slope of the frozen waterfall, she decided that she would not try to sneak away from Olaf and his troop. She would not try to sneak anywhere, because if you could see everything and everyone from Mount Fraught, that also meant everything and everyone, including Violet and Klaus Baudelaire, would be able to see her. Chapter 4. That night was a dark day. Of course, all nights are dark days, because night is simply a badly lit version of day. due to the fact that the Earth travels around and around the sun, reminding everyone that it is time to get out of bed and start the day with a cup of coffee or a secret message folded up into a paper airplane that can sail out the barred window of a ranger station. But in this case, the phrase a dark day means a sad time in the history of the Baudelaire children, VFD, and all kind, brave, and well-read people in the world. But Violet and Klaus Baudelaire, of course, had no idea of the catastrophe occurring high above them in the Valley of Four Drafts. All they knew was that they were hearing a voice they had hoped never to hear again.
"Go away, cake sniffers," the voice said. "This is a private cave."
"Who are you talking to, Carmelita?" asked another voice.
This voice was much louder and sounded like it belonged to a grown man.
"I can see two shadows in the entrance of the cave, Uncle Bruce," said the first voice, "and to me they look like cake sniffers."
The back of the cave echoed with giggling, and Violet and Klaus looked at one another in dismay. The familiar voice belonged to Carmelita Spatz, the nasty little girl whom the Baudelaires had encountered at Prufrock Preparatory School. Carmelita had taken an instant disliking to the three siblings, calling them unpleasant names and generally making life miserable at the academy. If you have ever been a student, then you know that there is usually one such person at every school, and that once you have graduated, you hope never to see them again. The two elder Baudelaires had enough troubles in the Mortmain Mountains without running into this unpleasant person, and at the sound of her voice, they almost turned around and took their chances once more with the snow gnats swarming outside.
"Two shadows?" asked the second voice. "Identify yourselves, please."
"We're mountain travellers," Violet called from the entrance. "We lost our way and ran into a swarm of snow gnats. Please let us rest here for a moment while the smell of smoke scares them away, and then we'll be on our way."
"Absolutely not," replied Carmelita,
who sounded even nastier than usual.
"This is where the snow scouts are camping, on their way to celebrate false spring and crown me queen. We don't want any cake sniffers spoiling our fun."
"Now, now, Carmelita," said the voice of the grown man. "Snow scouts are supposed to be accommodating, remember? It's part of the Snow Scout Alphabet Pledge, and it would be very accommodating of us to offer these strangers the shelter of our cave."
"I don't want to be accommodating," Carmelita said. "I'm the False Spring Queen, so I get to do whatever I want."
"You're not the False Spring Queen yet, Carmelita," came the patient voice of a young boy. "Not until we dance around the spring pole. Do come in, travellers, and sit by the fire. We're happy to accommodate you."
"That's the spirit, kid," said the voice of the grown man. "Come on, Snow Scouts. Let's all say the Snow Scout Alphabet Pledge together."
Instantly the cave echoed with the sound of many voices speaking in perfect unison, a phrase which here means reciting a list of very odd words at the very same time.
"Snow Scouts," recited the Snow Scouts, "are accommodating, basic, calm, darling, emblematic, frisky, grinning, human, innocent, jumping, kept, limited, meek, nap-loving, official, pretty, quarantined, recent, scheduled, tidy, understandable, victorious, wholesome, xylophone, young, and zippered, every morning, every afternoon, every night, and all day long."
The two Baudelaires looked at one another in confusion. Like many pledges, the Snow Scout Alphabet Pledge had not made much sense, and Violet and Klaus tried to imagine how a scout could be calm and meek at the same time as being frisky and jumping, or how all these children could avoid being young or human, even if they wanted to. They couldn't figure out why the pledge suggested being all these things every morning, every afternoon, and every night, and then added all day long, or why the word xylophone appeared in the pledge at all. But they did not have much time to wonder, because when the pledge was over, the Snow Scouts all took a big breath and made a long, airy sound, as if they were imitating the wind outside, and this seemed even more strange.
"That's my favourite part,"
said the voice of the grown man, when the sound faded away. "There's nothing like ending the Snow Scout alphabet pledge with a snowy sound. Now, approach, travellers, so we can get a look at you."
"Let's keep the coat over our faces," Klaus whispered to his sister. "Carmelita might recognize us.
And the other scouts have probably seen our pictures in the Daily Punctilio," Violet said, and ducked her head underneath the coat.
The Daily Punctilio was a newspaper that had published a story blaming the three Baudelaires for Jacques Snicket's murder. The story was utter nonsense, of course, but it seemed that everyone in the world had believed it and was searching for the Baudelaires to put them in jail. As the two siblings walked toward the voices of the Snow Scouts, however, they realized they weren't the only ones concealing their faces. The back of the cave was like a large circular room, with very high ceilings and craggy walls of rock that flickered in the orange light of the flames. Seated in a circle around the fire were 15 or 20 people, all looking up at the two Baudelaires. Through the fabric of the coat, the children could see that one person was much taller than the others. This was probably Bruce, and was wearing an ugly plaid coat and holding a large cigar. On the opposite side of the circle was someone wearing a thick wool sweater with several large pockets, and the rest of the Snow Scouts were wearing bright white uniforms with enormous zippers down the front and emblems of snowflakes in all different sizes and shapes along the long, puffy sleeves. On the back of the uniforms, the Baudelaires could see the words of the Snow Scout alphabet pledge printed in large pink letters, and on the top of everyone's heads were white headbands with tiny plastic snowflakes sticking out of the top in all directions, and the word brrr written in icy script. But Violet and Klaus weren't looking at the plastic flurries of snow on the Snow Scouts' heads, or the accommodating, basic, calm, darling, emblematic, frisky, grinning, human, innocent, jumping, kept, limited, meek, nap-loving, official, pretty, quarantined, recent, scheduled, tidy, understandable, victorious, wholesome, xylophone, young and zippered uniforms that most everyone was wearing. They were looking at the dark, round masks that were covering the scouts' faces. The masks were covered in tiny holes, much like masks worn for fencing, a sport in which people sword fight for fun rather than for honour, or in order to rescue a writer who has been taped to the wall. But in the flickering light of the cave, the Baudelaires could not see the holes, and it looked like the faces of Bruce and the Snow Scouts had vanished, leaving a dark and empty hole above their necks.
"You cake sniffers look ridiculous," said one of the scouts,
and the Baudelaires knew at once which masked figure was Carmelita Spatz.
"Your faces are all covered up."
"We're meek,"
Violet said, thinking quickly.
"In fact, we're so meek that we hardly ever show our faces."
"Then you'll fit in just fine," said Bruce from behind his mask. "The name's Bruce. But you can call me Uncle Bruce, although I'm almost certainly not your real uncle. Welcome to the Snow Scouts, travellers, where all of us are meek. In fact, we're accommodating, basic, calm."
The other Snow Scouts all joined in the pledge, and the two elder Baudelaires stood through another rendition of the absurd list, while the scout in the sweater stood up and stepped toward them.
"We have some spare masks over there," he murmured quietly, and gestured toward a large pile of equipment stacked beside a very long wooden pole. "They'll keep the snow gnats away when you go back outside. Help yourself."
"Thank you,"
Violet replied, as the scouts promised to be kept limited and meek. She and her brother quickly grabbed masks and put them on underneath the coat, so that by the time the scouts vowed to be xylophone young and zippered, they looked as faceless as everyone else in the cave.
"That was fun, kids," said Bruce, as the snowy sound faded and the pledge was over. "Now, why don't you two join the Snow Scouts? We're an organization for young people to have fun and learn new things. Right now, we're on a Snow Scouts hike. We're going to hike all the way up to Mount Fraught in order to celebrate False Spring."
"What's False Spring?" Violet asked, sitting down between her brother and the sweated scout.
"Anybody who's not a cake sniffer knows what False Spring is," Carmelita said in a scornful voice. "It's when the weather gets unusually warm before getting very cold again. We celebrate it with a fancy dance where we spin around and around the spring pole."
She pointed to the wooden pole, and the Baudelaires noticed that the Snow Scouts all wore bright white mittens, each emblazoned with an S.
"When the dance is over, we choose the best Snow Scout and crown her the False Spring Queen. This time it's me. In fact, it's always me."
"That's because Uncle Bruce is really your uncle," said one of the other Snow Scouts.
"No, it's not,"
Carmelita insisted.
"It's because I'm the most accommodating, basic, calm, darling, emblematic, frisky, grinning, human, innocent, jumping, kept, limited, meek, nap-loving, official, pretty, quarantine, recent, schedule, tidy, understandable, victorious, wholesome, xylophone, young, and zippered."
"How can anyone be xylophone?" Klaus couldn't help asking. "Xylophone isn't even an adjective." "Uncle Bruce couldn't think of another word that began with X," explained the sweated Snow Scout, in a tone of voice indicating that he thought this wasn't a very good excuse.
"How about xenial?" Klaus suggested. "It's a word that means..."
"You can't change the words of the Snow Scout alphabet pledge," Bruce interrupted, moving his cigar toward his face as if he were going to try and smoke it through the mask.
"The whole point of the Snow Scouts is that you do the same thing over and over. We celebrate False Spring over and over on Mount Fraught at the source of the stricken stream. My niece, Carmelita Spatz, is False Spring Queen over and over. And over and over, we stop here in this cave for Snow Scout story time."
"I read that the caves of the Mortmain Mountains contained hibernating animals," Klaus said. "Are you sure it's safe to stop here?" The Snow Scout, who was wearing a sweater instead of a uniform, turned his head quickly to the Baudelaires as if he was going to speak. But Bruce answered first.
"It's safe now, kid," he said. "Years ago, apparently these mountains were crawling with bears. The bears were so intelligent that they were trained as soldiers. But they disappeared, and no one knows why."
"Not bears," the scout in the sweater said, so quietly that the two Baudelaires had to lean in to hear him. "Lions lived in these caves, and they weren't soldiers. The lions were detectives, volunteer feline detectives." He turned so his mask was facing the two siblings, and the children knew he must be staring at them through the holes. "Volunteer feline detectives," he said again, and the Baudelaires almost gasped.
"Did you say..."
Violet said, but the sweated Snow Scout shook his head as if it was not safe to talk. Violet looked at her brother and then at the scout, wishing she could see both of their faces behind their masks. The initials of Volunteer Feline Detectives, of course, spelt VFD, the name of the organization they were looking for. But were these initials a coincidence, as they had seemed to be so many times? Or was this mysterious scout giving them some sort of signal.
"I don't know what you kids are muttering about," Bruce said, "but stop it this instant. It's not time for conversation. It's Snow Scout story time, when one Snow Scout tells a story to the other Snow Scouts. Then we'll all eat marshmallows until we feel sick and go to sleep on a heap of blankets, just like we do every year. Why don't our new Scouts tell the first story?"
"I should tell the first story," whined Carmelita. "After all, I'm the false spring queen."
"But I'm sure the travellers will have a wonderful story to tell," the sweated scout said. "I'd love to hear a very fascinating drama." Klaus saw his sister raise her hands to her head and smiled. He knew Violet had instinctively begun to tie her hair up in a ribbon to help her think, but it was impossible to do so with a mask on. Both the Baudelaire minds were racing to figure out a way to communicate with this mysterious scout, and the children were so lost in thought that they scarcely heard Carmelita Spatz insulting them.
"Stop sitting around, cake sniffers," Carmelita said. "If you're going to tell us a story, get started."
"I'm sorry for the delay," Violet said, choosing her words as carefully as she could. "We haven't had a very fun day, so it's difficult to think of a good story." "I didn't realize this was a sad occasion," said the sweated scout. "Oh, yes," Klaus said. "We've had nothing to eat all day except for some vinegar-flavored doughnuts." "And then there were the snow gnats," Violet said. "They behaved like violent frozen dragonflies." "When they form an arrow," Klaus said, "they're more like a voracious, fierce dragon." "Or a vain, fat dictator, I imagine," the scout in the sweater said, and gave the Baudelaires a masked nod, as if he had received their message.
"This is the most boring story I have ever heard," Carmelita Spatz said. "Uncle Bruce, tell these two that they're both cake sniffers."
"Well, it wouldn't be very accommodating to say so," Bruce said, "but I must admit that the story you were telling was a little dull, kids. When Snow Scouts tell stories, they skip everything boring and only tell the interesting parts. That way, the story can be as accommodating, basic, calm, darling, emblematic, frisky, grinning, human, innocent, jumping, kept limited, meek, nap-loving, official, pretty, quarantined, recent, scheduled, tidy, understandable, victorious, wholesome, xylophone, young, and zippered as possible."
"I'll show these cake sniffers how to tell an interesting story," Carmelita said. "Once upon a time, I woke up and looked in the mirror, and there I saw the prettiest, smartest, most darling girl in the whole wide world. I put on a lovely pink dress to make myself look even prettier, and I skipped off to school, where my teacher told me I looked more adorable than anyone she had ever seen in her entire life, and she gave me a lollipop as a special present."
At this point, I will take a page from someone's book, a phrase which here means adopt an idea used by somebody else. If, for instance, a man told you that the best way to write thank you notes is to reward yourself with a cookie every time you finished one, you might take a page from his book and have a plate of cookies nearby after your birthday or some other gift-giving occasion. If a girl told you that the best way to sneak out of the house late at night is to make sure everyone else is sound asleep, you might take a page from her book and mix a sleeping potion into everyone else's after-dinner coffee before climbing down the ivy that grows outside your bedroom window. And if you have been reading this miserable story, then the next time you find yourself in a similar situation, you might take a page from the slippery slope and use a combination of sticky substances and a drag chute to slow down a racing caravan, and then retrieve several articles of heavy clothing in order to protect yourself from the cold, and find a cave full of snow scouts gathered around a fire when the snow gnats begin to swarm. But I will be taking a page from Bruce's book, when he suggested that a storyteller only tell the interesting parts of the story and skip everything boring. Certainly, the two elder Baudelaires wished they could skip this boring part of their own story, as they were very eager to leave the cave and resume their search for their sister. But Violet and Klaus knew that they shouldn't leave the cave until they could talk to the mysterious boy in the sweater, and that they couldn't talk to the mysterious boy in the sweater in front of Bruce and the other snow scouts. And so they sat by the fire as Carmelita Spatz talked on and on about how pretty and smart and darling she was, and how everyone she met told her that she was unbelievably adorable. Although the Baudelaires had to sit through these tedious portions of their story, there is no reason for you to do so. And so I will skip ahead, past the tiresome details of Carmelita's endless story, and the senseless pledge that Bruce made everyone say several more times, and the all-marshmallow meal that the scout shared with the two siblings. I will skip how irksome it was for Violet and Klaus to turn away from the scouts, quickly lift their masks, and pop marshmallows into their mouths before covering their faces again so they would not be recognized. After their long, tiring journey, the children would have preferred a more substantial supper, and a less complicated way of eating it, but the siblings could not skip these parts of their story, so they had to wait for the evening to pass, and for all the other snow scouts to feel sick, and arrange blankets into a large heap beside the spring pole. Even when Bruce led the snow scouts in one more alphabet pledge as a way of saying good night, Violet and Klaus dared not get up and talk to the sweated scout, for fear of being overheard, and they had to wait for hours, too curious and anxious to sleep, as the fire died down and the cave echoed with the sounds of Snow Scout snoring. But I will take a page from the book of the Snow Scout leader and skip ahead to the next interesting thing that happened, which was very, very late at night, when so many interesting parts of stories happen, and so many people miss them, because they are asleep in their beds, or hiding in the broom closet of a mustard factory, disguised as a dustpan to fool the night watchwoman. It was very late at night. In fact, one might say that it was the darkest part of this dark day. And it was so late that the Baudelaires had almost given up on staying awake, particularly after such an exhausting day. But just as the two siblings were beginning to fall asleep, they each felt a hand touch them on the shoulder, and they quickly sat up and found themselves looking into the masked face of the sweated scout.
"Come with me, Baudelaires," the boy said in a very quiet voice. "I know a shortcut to the headquarters."
And this was an interesting part of the story, indeed. Chapter 5. When you have many questions on your mind, and you suddenly have an opportunity to ask them, the questions tend to crowd together and trip over one another, much like passengers on a crowded train when it reaches a popular station. With Bruce and the Snow Scouts asleep, the two elder Baudelaires finally had an opportunity to talk with the mysterious scout in the sweater. But everything they wanted to ask seemed hopelessly entangled.
"How?"
Violet started. But the question, "How did you know we were the Baudelaires?" stumbled against the question, "Who are you?" and fell back against the questions, "Are you a member of VFD, and what does VFD stand for?"
"Do,"
Klaus said, but the question, "Do you know where our sister is?"
tripped over the question, "Do you know if one of our parents is alive?" which was already struggling with, "How can we get to the headquarters?" and "Will my sisters and I ever find a safe place to live without constantly being threatened by Count Olaf and his troop as they hatch plan after plan to steal the Baudelaire fortune?" although the middle Baudelaire knew that his last question was unlikely to be answered at all. "I'm sure you have lots of questions," the boy whispered, "but we can't talk here. Bruce is a light sleeper, and he's caused VFD enough trouble already without learning another of our secrets. I promise all your questions will be answered, but first we've got to get to the headquarters. Come with me." Without another word, the sweated scout turned around, and the Baudelaires saw he was wearing a backpack inscribed with an insignia they had seen at Caligari Carnival. At first glance, this insignia merely appeared to be an eye, but the children had discovered that if you looked closely, you could see the initials VFD cleverly hidden in the drawing. The scout began to walk, and the two siblings got out of their blankets as quietly as they could and followed him. To their surprise, he did not lead them toward the cave entrance, but to the back of the cave, where the snow scout's fire had been. Now it was nothing more than a pile of grey ashes, although it was still very warm, and the smell of smoke was still in the air. The sweated scout reached into his pocket and brought out a flashlight. "I had to wait for the fire to die down before I showed you," he said, and with a nervous glance at the sleeping scouts, turned the flashlight on and shone it above them. "Look!" Violet and Klaus looked and saw that there was a hole in the ceiling big enough for a person to crawl through. The last wisps of smoke from the fire were floating up into the hole. "A chimney!" Klaus murmured. "I was wondering why the fire didn't fill the cave with smoke." "The official name is vertical flame diversion," the scout whispered. "It serves as a chimney and as a secret passageway. It runs from this cave to the Valley of Four Drafts. If we climb up there, we can reach headquarters within hours instead of hiking all the way up the mountain. Years ago, there was a metal pole that ran down the center of the hole so people could slide down and hide in this cave in case of an emergency. The pole is gone now, but there should be carved toe holes in the sides to climb all the way up." He shone the flashlight on the cave wall, and sure enough, the Baudelaires could see two rows of small carved holes, perfect for sticking one's feet and hands. "How do you know all this?" Violet asked. The scout looked at her for a moment, and it seemed to the Baudelaires that he was smiling behind his mask. "I read it," he said, "in a book called Remarkable Phenomena of the Mortmain Mountains." "That sounds familiar," Klaus said. "It should," the scout replied. "I borrowed it from Dr. Montgomery's library." Dr. Montgomery was one of the Baudelaire's first guardians, and at the mention of his name, Violet and Klaus found they had several more questions they wanted to ask. "When?" Violet started. "Why?" Klaus started.
"Come!"
Another voice startled the Baudelaires and the scout. The voice of Bruce, waking up halfway at the sound of the conversation. All three children froze for a moment, as Bruce turned over on his blanket and with a long sigh, went back to sleep.
"We'll talk when we reach the headquarters," the scout whispered. "The vertical flame diversion is very echoey, so we'll have to be absolutely silent as we climb, or the echoing noise will alert Bruce and the snow scouts. It'll be very dark inside, so you'll have to feel against the wall for the footholds, and the air will be smoky, but if you keep your masks on, they'll filter the air and make it easier to breathe. I'll go first and lead the way. Are you ready?"
Violet and Klaus turned toward one another. Even though they could not see each other's faces through the masks, both siblings knew that they were not at all ready.
following a complete stranger into a secret passageway through the center of the mountains toward a headquarters they could not even be sure existed, did not seem like a very safe thing to do. The last time they had agreed to take a risky journey, their baby sister had been snatched away from them. What would happen this time, when they were all alone with a mysterious masked figure in a dark and smoky hole? "I know it must be hard to trust me, Baudelaire's," said the sweated scout, "after so many people have done you wrong."
"Can you give us a reason to trust you?" Violet said.
The scout looked down for a moment and then turned his mask to face both Baudelaire's.
"One of you mentioned the word xenial," he said, "when you were talking with Bruce about that silly pledge.
Xenial is a word which refers to the giving of gifts to a stranger."
"He's right,"
Klaus murmured to his sister.
"I know that having a good vocabulary doesn't guarantee that I'm a good person," the boy said, "but it does mean I've read a great deal. And in my experience, well-read people are less likely to be evil."
Violet and Klaus looked at one another through their masks. Neither of them were entirely convinced by what the masked scout had said. "There are, of course, plenty of evil people who have read a great many books, and plenty of very kind people who seem to have found some other method of spending their time. But the Baudelaires knew that there was a kind of truth to the boy's statement, and they had to admit that they preferred to take their chances with a stranger who knew what the word xenial meant, rather than exiting the cave and trying to find the headquarters all by themselves. So the siblings turned back to the scout, nodded their masks, and followed him to the footholds in the wall, making sure they still had all the items from the caravan with them. The footholds were surprisingly easy to use, and in a short time the Baudelaires were following the mysterious scout into the dark and smoky entrance of the passageway. The vertical flame diversion that connected the Mortmain Mountain headquarters to this particular volunteer feline detective's cave was once one of the most heavily guarded secrets in the world. Anyone who wanted to use it had to correctly answer a series of questions concerning the force of gravity, the habits of carnivorous beasts, and the central themes of Russian novels. So very few people even knew the passageway's exact whereabouts. Until the two Baudelaires' journey, the passageway had not been used for many years, ever since one of my comrades removed the pole in order to use it in the construction of a submarine. So it would be accurate to say that the vertical flame diversion was a road less travelled, even less travelled, than the path through the Mortmain Mountains on which this book began. While the elder Baudelaires had a very good reason to be on the road less travelled, as they were in a great hurry to reach the headquarters and rescue their sister from the clutches of Count Olaf, there is no reason whatsoever why you should be on the road less travelled and choose to read the rest of this woeful chapter, which describes their dark and smoky journey. The ashen air from the Snow Scout's fire was difficult to breathe, even through the masks, and Violet and Klaus had to struggle not to cough, knowing that the coughing sound would echo down the passageway and wake up Bruce. But there is no reason for you to struggle through my dismal description of this problem. A number of spiders had noticed that the footholds were not being used lately, and had moved in and converted them into spider condominiums. But you are under no obligation to read what happens when spiders are suddenly woken up by the sudden appearance of a climbing foot in their new homes. And as the Baudelaires followed the scout farther and farther up, the strong, freezing winds from the top of the mountain would rush through the passageway, and all three youngsters would cling to the footholds with their very lives, hoping that the wind would not blow them back down to the cave floor. But although the Baudelaires found it necessary to keep climbing through the rest of the dark day so they could reach the headquarters as quickly as possible,
and I find it necessary to finish describing it so my account of the Baudelaire case is as accurate and as complete as possible, it is not necessary for you to finish reading the rest of this chapter, so you can be as miserable as possible. My description of the Baudelaire's journey up through the road less travelled begins on the next page, but I beg you not to travel along with them. Instead, you may take a page from Bruce's book and skip ahead to Chapter 6 and find my report on Sonny Baudelaire's tribulations, a word which here means opportunities to eavesdrop while cooking for a theatre troupe, with Count Olaf, or you may skip ahead to Chapter 7, when the elder Baudelaires arrive at the site of the VFD headquarters and unmask the stranger who led them there. Or you may take the road very frequently travelled and skip away from this book altogether and find something better to do with your time besides finishing this unhappy tale and becoming a weary, weeping, and well-read person. The Baudelaire's journey up the vertical flame diversion was so dark and treacherous that it is not enough to write, "The Baudelaire's journey up the vertical flame diversion was so dark and treacherous that it is not enough to write, "The Baudelaire's journey up the vertical flame diversion was so dark and treacherous that it is not enough to write, "My dear sister, I am taking a great risk in hiding a letter to you inside one of my books, but I am certain that even the most melancholy and well-read people in the world have found my account of the lives of the three Baudelaire children even more wretched than I had promised, and so this book will stay on the shelves of libraries, utterly ignored, waiting for you to open it and find this message. As an additional precaution, I placed a warning that the rest of this chapter contains a description of the Baudelaire's miserable journey up the vertical flame diversion, so anyone who has the courage to read such a description is probably brave enough to read my letter to you. I have at last learned the whereabouts of the evidence that will exonerate me, a phrase which here means prove to the authorities that it is Count Olaf and not me who has started so many fires. Your suggestion, so many years ago at that picnic, that a tea set would be a handy place to hide anything important and small in the event of a dark day, has turned out to be correct. Incidentally, your other picnic suggestion, that a simple combination of sliced mango, black beans and chopped celery mixed with black pepper, lime juice and olive oil would make a delicious chilled salad, also turned out to be correct. I am on my way now to the Valley of Four Draughts, in order to continue my research on the Baudelaire case. I hope also to retrieve the aforementioned evidence at last. It is too late to restore my happiness, of course, but at least I can clear my name. From the site of VFD headquarters, I will head straight for the Hotel des Noumonts. I should arrive by, well, it wouldn't be wise to type the date, but it should be easy for you to remember Beatrice's birthday. Meet me at the hotel. Try to get us a room without ugly curtains. With all due respect, Lemony Snicket. P.S. If you substitute the chopped celery with hearts of palm, it is equally delicious. Chapter 6. In the very early hours of the morning, while the two elder Baudelaires struggle to find their footing as they climbed up the vertical flame diversion, and I sincerely hope that you did not read the description of that journey, the youngest Baudelaire found herself struggling with a different sort of footing altogether. Sunny had not enjoyed the long, cold night on Mount Fraught. If you have ever slept in a covered casserole dish on the highest peak of a mountain range, then you know that it is an uncomfortable place to lay one's head, even if you find a dish towel inside it that can serve as a blanket.
All night long, the chilly mountain winds blew through the tiny holes inside the top of the cover, making it so cold inside the dish that Sunny's enormous teeth chattered all night, giving her tiny cuts on her lips and making such a loud noise that it was impossible to sleep. Finally, when the first rays of the morning sun shone through the holes and made it warm enough to doze, Count Olaf left his tent and kicked open the cover of the dish to begin ordering Sunny around.
"Wake up, you dentist nightmare," he cried.
Sunny opened one exhausted eye and found herself staring at the villain's footing, particularly the tattoo on Olaf's left ankle, a sight that was enough to make her wish her eyes were still closed. Tattooed on Olaf's ankle was the image of an eye, and it seemed to Sunny that this eye had been watching the Baudelaires throughout all of their troubles, from the day on Briny Beach when they learned of the terrible fire that destroyed their home. Time after time, Count Olaf had tried to hide this eye so the authorities would not recognize him, so the children were always uncovering it behind his ridiculous disguises. And the Baudelaires had begun seeing the eye in other places, such as at the office of an evil hypnotist, on the side of a carnival tent, on Esme Squalor's purse, and on a necklace owned by a mysterious fortune-teller. It was almost as if this eye had replaced the eyes of her parents. But instead of keeping watch over the children and making sure that they were safe from harm, this eye merely gave them a blank stare, as if it did not care about the children's troubles, or could do nothing about them. If you looked very closely, you could find the letters VFD half hidden in the eye, and this reminded Sunny of all the sinister secrets that surrounded the three siblings, and how far they were from understanding the web of mystery in which they found themselves. But it is hard to think about mysteries and secrets first thing in the morning, particularly if someone is yelling at you, and Sunny turned her attention to what her captor was saying.
"You'll be doing all the cooking and cleaning for us, orphan," Count Olaf said, "and you could start by making us breakfast. We have a big day ahead of us, and a good breakfast will give me and my troop the energy we need to perform unspeakable crimes."
"Plackner?"
Sunny asked, which meant, how am I supposed to cook breakfast on the top of a freezing mountain? But Count Olaf just gave her a nasty smile.
"Too bad your brain isn't as big as your teeth, you little monkey," he said. "You're talking nonsense as usual."
Sunny sighed, frustrated that there was no one on top of the Mortmain Mountains who understood what she was trying to say.
"Translow,"
she said, which meant, just because you don't understand something doesn't mean that it's nonsense.
"There you go, babbling again," Olaf said, and tossed Sunny the car keys. "Get the groceries out of the trunk of the car and get to work."
Sunny suddenly thought of something that might cheer her up a little bit.
"Sneaky talk,"
she said, which was her way of saying, "Of course, because you don't understand me. I can say anything I want to you, and you'll have no idea what I'm talking about."
"I'm getting quite tired of your ridiculous speech impediment," Count Olaf said.
"Bramel,"
Sunny said, which meant, in my opinion, you desperately need a bath and your clothing is a shambles.
"Be quiet this instant," Olaf ordered.
"Bishini,"
Sunny said, which meant something along the lines of, "You're an evil man with no concern whatsoever for other people."
"Shut up,"
Count Olaf roared.
"Shut up and get cooking."
Sunny got out of the casserole dish and stood up, looking down at the snowy ground so the villain would not see she was smiling. It is not nice to tease people, of course, but the youngest Baudelaire felt that it was all right to enjoy a joke at the expense of such a murderous and evil man, and she walked to Olaf's car with a spring in her step, a phrase which here means, in a surprisingly cheerful manner, considering she was in the clutches of a ruthless villain on top of a mountain so cold that even the nearby waterfall was frozen solid. But when Sunny Baudelaire opened the trunk of the car, her smile faded. Under normal circumstances, it is not safe to keep groceries in the trunk of a car for an extended period of time, because some foods will spoil without being refrigerated. But Sunny saw that the temperatures of the Mortmain Mountains had caused the groceries to become over-refrigerated. A thin layer of frost covered every item, and Sunny had to crawl inside and wipe the frost off with her bare hands to see what she might make for the troop. There was a variety of well-chilled food that Olaf had stolen from the carnival, but none of it seemed like the makings of a good breakfast. There was a bag of coffee beans beneath the harpoon gun, and a frozen hunk of spinach, but there was no way to grind the beans into tiny pieces to make coffee. Nearby a picnic basket and a large bag of mushrooms was a jug of orange juice, but it had been close to one of the bullet holes in the trunk, and so had frozen completely solid in the cold. And after Sunny moved aside three chunks of cold cheese, a large can of water chestnuts, and an eggplant as big as herself, she finally found a small jar of boysenberry jam and a loaf of bread she could use to make toast, although it was so cold it felt more like a log than a breakfast ingredient.
"Wake up!"
Sunny peeked out of the trunk and saw Count Olaf calling through the door of one of the tents she had assembled.
"Wake up and get dressed for breakfast."
"Can't we sleep 10 minutes more?" asked the whiny voice of the hook-handed man.
"I was having a lovely dream about sneezing without covering my nose and mouth and giving everybody germs."
"Absolutely not," Olaf replied. "I have lots of work for you to do."
"But Olaf,"
said Esme Squalor, emerging from the tent she had shared with Count Olaf. Her hair was in curlers, and she was wearing a long robe and a pair of fuzzy slippers.
"I need a little while to choose what I'm going to wear. It's not in to burn down a headquarters without wearing a fashionable outfit."
Sunny gasped in the trunk. She had known that Olaf was eager to reach the VFT headquarters as soon as possible in order to get his hands on the rest of some crucial evidence, but it had not occurred to her that he would combine this evidence-grabbing with his usual pyromania, a word which here means a love of fire, usually the product of a deranged mind.
"I can't imagine why you need all this time,"
was Count Olaf's grumpy reply to his girlfriend.
"After all, I wear the same outfit for weeks at a time, except when I'm in disguise, and I look almost unbearably handsome." "Well, I suppose you have a few minutes before breakfast is ready. Slow service is one of the disadvantages of having infants for slaves."
Olaf strode over to the car and peered in at Sunny, who was still clutching the loaf of bread.
"Hurry up, big mouth," he growled at Sunny. "I need a nice hot meal to take the chill out of the morning."
"Unfeasy,"
Sunny cried. By unfeasy, she meant, to make a hot meal without any electricity, I'd need a fire, and expecting a baby to start a fire all by herself on top of a snowy mountain is cruelly impossible and impossibly cruel. But Olaf merely frowned.
"Your baby talk is really beginning to annoy me," he said.
"Hygiene,"
Sunny said, to make herself feel better. She meant something along the lines of, "Additionally, you ought to be ashamed of yourself for wearing the same outfit for weeks at a time without washing." But Olaf merely scowled at her and walked back into his tent. Sunny looked at the cold ingredients and tried to think. Even if she had been old enough to start a fire by herself, Sunny had always been nervous around flames, since the fire that had destroyed the Baudelaire mansion. But as she thought of the fire that destroyed her own home, she remembered something her mother had told her once. They had both been busy in the kitchen. Sunny's mother was busy preparing for a fancy luncheon, and Sunny was busy dropping a fork on the floor over and over again to see what sort of sound it made. The luncheon was due to start any minute, and Sunny's mother was quickly mixing up a salad of sliced mango, black beans, and chopped celery, mixed with black pepper, lime juice, and olive oil.
"This isn't a very complicated recipe, Sunny," her mother had said. "But if I arrange the salad very nicely on